Imagine you send a single email, you're blasting out a market update, and you accidentally CC one wrong person. Because of that one slip of the finger, you haven't just made, you know, a social faux pas. You've broken federal regulations.
Okay.
You've potentially triggered an immediate regulatory audit and, well, put your firm's license in jeopardy. Today, we're looking at a massive stack of FINRA rules, SEC regulations, and historical enforcement actions to figure out how to navigate the absolute minefield that is broker-dealer communication.
It is a minefield. Oh. And honestly, it's where most principals end up ending their careers prematurely.
Wow.
Yeah. The rules of engagement for what you can say, how you say it, and who you say it to are just unforgiving.
Right, right. Well, before we jump into the deep end, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full series 24 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. Okay, so let's unpack this stack of sources. The mission today is decoding the communications with the public gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
If you're digging into function 3 of the series 24, this is the substance layer. We aren't just talking about trade execution. We're talking about the legal reality of marketing, advertising, and, well, picking up the phone.
Yeah, and the reason this material is so dense and the reason principals get trapped is that the exact same flyer, I mean, word for word, can trigger entirely different rules based on the eyes that are reading it.
Right.
The audience dictates the workflow.
Which brings us to the foundational framework, the three buckets. I was looking through this FINRA guidance, and it all really boils down to the 25-investor, 30-day test.
Yeah, that test is your compass. Every single piece of written communication your firm produces falls into one of three buckets.
Okay.
Institutional, retail, or correspondence. If you classify the document incorrectly on day one, every subsequent step you take will be a violation.
That's terrible.
It is. The category dictates who approves it, whether it gets filed with FINRA, and how long you have to keep it on a server.
So let's build a narrative here to help this stick, especially for those of us who need a good story to remember this stuff. We're going to follow a guy named Financial Frank.
Okay, Financial Frank.
Frank is ambitious, a little sloppy, and he just started his own broker-dealer. So Frank is drafting this beautiful full-color brochure about a new investment strategy. Bucket number one is institutional.
Right.
This is communication distributed only to institutional investors. No retail eyes allowed whatsoever. But who actually counts as institutional? Let's introduce a character from our research notes. Institutional Ian.
I like it. Institutional Ian is a great mental model. Think of Ian as, you know, wearing a three-piece suit made entirely out of $1,000 bills.
Naturally.
He represents entities that regulators assume can fend for themselves. So banks, savings and loans, insurance companies, registered investment companies, and SEC registered investment advisors.
But the regulators also include certain individuals or everyday entities, right? Provided they meet a massive threshold.
Correct. A person or entity can be institutional, Ian, if they have $50 million in total assets.
Total assets. Okay. Yeah. Because I noticed in the enforcement actions that this is a classic area where test writers and regulators try to trick people.
Oh, all the time.
They'll throw a scenario at you with an incredibly wealthy individual. Let's say a guy with a $5 million net worth or an income of $2 million a year. And my instinct is, well, that guy is rich. He's institutional.
And your instinct would earn you a failure.
Ha, brutal.
Yeah, wealth does not equal institutional status in this specific FINRA rule. The threshold is a hard $50 million in total assets, not net worth, total assets. If they have $49 million, they are a retail investor.
Wow. Okay, there is also a very specific carve-out for employee benefit plans that caught my eye.
Yes, employee benefit plans, like a 401k or a pension, they can qualify as institutional, but they need to have at least 100 participants.
Oh, 100.
Right, exactly. The trap here is a plan with, say, 95 participants, but $1 billion in assets.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much money is in the plan. If it has 95 participants, it is a retail investor.
It's all about the bodies. Okay, so that's institutional, Ian. Let's look at the other side of the coin. Retail Rita.
Retail Rita.
She is the everyday investor. If Frank sends his brochure to Retail Rita, we are in the retail bucket or the correspondence bucket. The dividing line is the volume and the time frame.
The rule is strictly quantitative here. If Frank sends that communication to more than 25 retail investors within any 30 calendar day period, it is a retail communication.
Okay.
If he sends it to 25 or fewer retail investors within a 30-day period, It's correspondence.
So 26 is the magic number for retail.
Yes.
And 25 is correspondence. But here is where the rules get really terrifying. The contamination rule.
Oh, this one is tough.
It just proves why intent and audience matter so much. I like to picture an institutional communication as a highly sterile, high-tech clean room.
Okay, I can see that.
Financial Frank is in a hazmat suit. Institutional Ian is in a hazmat suit. They're trading complex, high-level data. Now let's say retail Rita wanders into that clean room just to ask for directions.
The clean room is breached. The institutional status is instantly destroyed. The FINRA rule contains the word only, distributed only to institutional investors. It is completely unforgiving.
Wow. Okay, direct question to you. Listening to this deep dive right now, pause and think about this. Financial Frank drafts a highly complex email about derivatives. He sends a blast to 500 institutional clients, all institutional liens. But Frank is sloppy, and he accidentally CCs his cousin, Retail Rita, on the email. What is that email classified as now? Give it a beat.
It's a retail communication.
Yep.
Frank just sent a retail communication to 501 people. And because he thought it was institutional, he didn't get it pre-approved by your principal. He didn't follow the retail content standards, and he isn't going to file it with FUD on a row.
Right.
One accidental CC just triggered a cascade of massive regulatory violations.
It's an absolute nightmare. Frank is going to get audited into oblivion.
Oh, totally.
But what if Frank isn't writing an email? What if Frank rents out a hotel ballroom, gets on a stage, and starts pitching his strategy to a room of 200 retail Ritas?
Okay, so now we step outside the three written buckets and into the realm of public appearances.
Okay.
When Frank is on stage giving a seminar, or he's a guest on a live radio show, or hosting a live interactive webinar, that does not count toward the 25 investor 30-day rule.
So we can just say whatever he wants.
Well, not at all. He still has to follow all the baseline content standards, like no lying, no misleading statements. But structurally, it's not considered a written retail communication in that exact moment. It's fluid.
Gotcha. I was reading a specific SEC guidance note on this, and it feels like a massive trap waiting to happen.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Frank records that live webinar. It went great. He takes the video file and posts it on his firm's website for anyone to watch. What happens if 26 retail investors click play on that video over the next week?
Yep. That public appearance just magically transformed into a written retail communication.
Because it's no longer live.
That's exactly.
It's a static recorded asset distributed to more than 25 retail people.
Precisely. The live event is a public appearance. The archive recording distributed to the public is a retail communication. And because it just changed categories, it triggers a whole new set of rules about who has to sign off on it.
Which brings us to the approval workflow.
Yes.
Right? Let's follow Frank's paperwork. We know the buckets, institutional, correspondence, retail. Who actually has to sign this paper?
It fundamentally comes down to pre-use versus post-use supervision. Retail communications, because they have mass reach, require pre-use approval by a registered principal.
Meaning before Frank drops that brochure in the mail or before it's filed with FINRA, a principal has to physically or electronically sign and date it.
Yes.
Okay.
Correspondence and institutional communications, on the other hand, do not require pre-use approval. They require supervisory review based on the firm's written supervisory procedures, or WSPs.
Oh, so it's different.
Yeah, this is usually done after the fact on a risk or sampling basis.
See, I was looking at this and thinking, isn't that insanely dangerous? If Financial Frank emails 18 of his retail clients, which makes it correspondence because it's under 26.
Right.
A principal doesn't have to read that email before Frank hits send. Frank is a loose cannon. Why would regulators allow that?
Well, it's a concession to reality. The volume of correspondence in any modern broker-dealer is astronomically high. If a principal had to pre-approve every single email sent to five clients, the business would just grind to an absolute halt. Wall Street would freeze.
Okay, that makes sense.
So the rule relies on the firm to spot check it effectively post-use. The firm might review a random 10% of emails or use lexicon software to flag risky keywords like guarantee or promissory. But retail gets the pre-use magnifying glass because the blast radius is so much larger.
Ah, the blast radius.
Yeah, if Frank makes a mistake in a retail piece, thousands of people are misled instantly.
Okay, that logic tracks perfectly. So when the principal does review that retail piece, what are the actual mechanics of the sign-off?
The approval must be explicitly evidenced by a signature or initials, and it must include the date of the approval.
Okay.
If a principal reads it, nods, and emails Frank saying, hey, looks good to me, but doesn't formally sign and date the record, it's a books and records violation.
and who is actually allowed to sign it? Because not all principles are created equal.
Oh, this is a classic area where test writers love to catch people off guard. Series 27 and Series 28 principles, the financial and operations principles, or FinOps, cannot approve advertising content.
The Series 27 is the math nerd. They handle the net capital computations and the firm's books. They are not the marketing police.
Exactly. Usually you need a Series 24 general securities principle or a Series 26 investment company principle to approve communications. If you see a scenario where a Series 27 signs off on a brochure, that approval is invalid.
So Frank essentially published an unapproved retail communication.
Yep.
Are there any exceptions to this retail pre-approval rule? Because we live in the era of social media. What if Frank is on Twitter?
Regulators had to adapt to that, so they created a major exception for interactive forums. Social media dialogue, like a real-time back and forth on a Reddit thread or a live reply to someone on Twitter, gets post-use review. It's treated more like a public appearance because it's spontaneous and interactive.
But let me draw a distinction here, because the phrasing is critical. What if Financial Frank goes into Hootsuite or Buffer and schedules a highly produced, pre-drafted promotional tweet to go live next Tuesday at noon?
Oh, that is not interactive dialogue.
Right.
That is static marketing. It's a digital billboard. Therefore, it is a retail communication that requires pre-use approval by a principal.
Mm-hmm.
The dividing line is spontaneity versus scheduled promotion.
Okay, so Frank got it right this time. He made a static retail piece. The Series 24 principal signed and dated it. Now, do we have to send it to the government? Let's open the FunRA filing cabinet.
Filing with FunRA's Advertising Regulation Department is its own complex web. But the absolute best way to navigate it is to start by aggressively filtering out what you never ever file.
Oh, I love this. Let's do a pattern interrupt right here. Shake out your arms, take a deep breath, and listen closely to this part. If you're asked when correspondence is filed with FunRA, the answer is never. Institutional communications, never. Generic, purely educational ads, never. Tombstone announcements, never.
That's the filter. The only thing we are talking about filing from here on out are specific types of retail communications. And for those pieces, FunRA operates mostly on 10-day windows.
And it's divided into post-use and pre-use.
Right. The default rule for most retail communications, things like mutual fund advertisements, CMOs, direct participation programs, is that they are filed within 10 business days of first use. That is a post-use filing. You publish it to the world, and you have 10 days to get it to FunRA's desk.
So Frank runs a mutual fund ad in a magazine on a Monday. He has 10 business days to send that tier sheet to FunRA.
Yes.
But reading through the rule book, there are flips. Some things are deemed so risky or so easily manipulated that FunRA wants to see them before Frank runs them.
The pre-use flips. There are two major categories that require filing at least 10 business days before first use.
Okay, what are they?
Number one, retail communications with self-created performance rankings. Number two, security futures retail communications.
Let's focus on that first one because it explains the logic. If Frank uses a Morningstar ranking for his mutual fund, FunRA is fine with a post-use filing because Morningstar is an independent, objective third party.
Exactly.
But if Frank's firm creates their own proprietary ranking system that magically shows their fund is number one, FunRA does not trust a firm grading its own homework.
That's the exact logic. They want 10 days to review Frank's methodology before a single retail investor sees it.
Oh, man. Test writers love this flip. They'll give you a mutual fund ad scenario. You know mutual funds are post-use, but then they slide in the detail that it's a mutual fund ad with a self-created ranking.
Right.
Suddenly, the requirement flips from 10 days after to 10 days before.
And we should clarify a workflow point here. Filing with FunRA is completely independent of principal approval. Frank still needs his Series 24 principal to approve the document internally. Then it goes to FunRA pre-use. Then, and only then, it goes to the public.
Now, earlier we established that Frank just started his own broker-dealer. Does a brand new firm get treated the same as Goldman Sachs?
Definitely not. FunRA employs the new member firm rule. For their first year of FunRA membership, new firms are on probation. They must pre-file every single retail communication that goes into electronic or public media, broad reach marketing.
Wow.
At least 10 days before use. FunRA doesn't have a track record with Frank yet, so they want to review everything before it hits the streets.
Direct question to the listener. Think about this. When does that one-year probationary clock start for Frank's new firm? Is it when he files his incorporation papers? Is it when he registers with the SEC? Pause for a second. Think about it.
It starts upon FunRA membership effectiveness. That is the exact date the 365-day clock begins. If Frank's firm has been SEC registered for 5 years as an advisor, but just got approved as a FINRA broker-dealer today, he's a new member for the purposes of this rule. The clock starts today.
All right, so Frank categorized the flyer perfectly. The principal approved it, FIR got it 10 days prior. We've done all the procedural paperwork. But what if the beautiful approved filed brochure actually just contains complete and utter lies? This brings us to the content standards.
This is the substance layer. FINRA requires every communication, whether it's a tweet, a billboard, or a 50-page prospectus, to satisfy four general standards.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, fair dealing and good faith. You cannot design a communication to take advantage of an investor's naivete. Second, fair and balanced. If you dedicate a page to the shiny benefits, you must dedicate space to the ugly risks. Third, sound basis. You need to provide enough factual foundation for the investor to actually evaluate the product. And fourth, appropriate for the audience. What's perfectly fine for institutional Ian might be incredibly misleading for retail Rita.
And reading through the enforcement actions, regulators don't just go after direct lies. A lie of omission is just as illegal, if not more so, than a direct fabrication.
Oh, absolutely.
Let me give you a scenario. Frank writes in his brochure, this fund returned 20% in year one, 15% in year two, and 18% in year four. What did Frank just do?
He skipped year three.
Exactly. And let's say in year three, the fund lost 40%. The numbers Frank provided for years one, two, and four are technically mathematically true, but omitting year three makes the entire communication a massive violation because it denies the investor the sound basis to evaluate the volatility.
Misleading by omission is the quickest way to get fined. You also cannot make false, exaggerated, or promissory statements. Regulators are obsessed with the no crystal ball rule.
So Financial Frank cannot look retail Rita in the eye or write in a brochure. Based on my analysis, this tech stock will definitively hit $100 a share by Q3.
Absolutely not. You cannot imply certainty about returns or market direction. Predicting or projecting performance is heavily restricted.
But wait, I go on my broker's website all the time and use those retirement calculators that tell me I'll have $2 million by age 65 if I save $500 a month. Isn't that projecting performance?
Well, that is the one major safe harbor, the investment analysis tool.
Oh.
Regulators recognize that mathematical simulations are useful for planning, but the safe harbor comes with thick strings attached. A qualifying tool can produce probability simulations like a Monte Carlo analysis, but it must include strict disclosures.
Like what?
You must disclose the criteria and methodology used. State clearly that results may vary over time, ensure there is no implication of certainty, and include prominent disclaimers that the tool relies on assumptions that may not happen.
Right.
Without those disclosures prominently displayed, that helpful retirement calculator is an illegal projection.
Okay, so Frank can't predict the future, but can he get a client to talk about the past? Let's talk testimonials.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Frank has a client. Let's call him Happy Harry. Harry made an absolute fortune investing with Frank. Frank wants to put Happy Harry's face on a billboard with a quote saying, Frank doubled my money in 6 months. If Frank uses Harry's testimonial, what are the three hurdles he has to clear?
Testimonials are inherently dangerous because retail investors project that success onto themselves. So if you use one, you need three explicit disclosures.
Okay, wait a minute.
Number one, is this a typical experience? If Happy Harry is an anomaly, which he almost certainly is, you have to state that his results are not typical and do not represent the experience of other clients.
Makes sense.
Number two, you must include the classic industry standard disclaimer that past performance is no guarantee of future results. And number three, which is highly testable, did you pay Harry for this testimonial? If you paid him more than $100 in value, you must disclose the fact that it is a paid endorsement.
Okay, regulators love to test this by giving you a scenario where Frank puts a testimonial in a brochure. The brochure clearly says results not typical, and it clearly discloses that he paid Harry $150. And they ask, is Frank compliant? Pause. Think. No, he missed the past performance disclaimer. When test writers build these questions, they will almost always give you two of the three requirements. It's always a violation unless all three are present.
And pay attention to that $100 threshold. Why $100? Regulators are trying to establish materiality. If Frank buys Harry a $50 gift card as a thank you, it's not deemed material enough to bias the testimonial.
Right.
But if he buys him a $150 dinner at a steakhouse, that crosses the line of materiality. The compensation that must be disclosed.
Now, what happens if Frank isn't making his own claims? What if Frank is lazy and he's just linking to someone else's website on his social media?
Now we're into the digital age rules of hyperlinks, specifically the doctrines of adoption and entanglement.
I love this concept. Frank doesn't write the lie. He just links to a third-party blog that contains the lie. Can Frank throw his hands up and say, hey, I didn't write it, don't look at me?
He cannot, assuming he has adopted or entangled himself with that content.
Mm-hmm.
If you link to something and you helped write it or influenced its creation, that's entanglement, FINRA treats it as yours.
Okay.
Alternatively, if you didn't write it, but you vouch for it or endorse it when you share the link, that's adoption.
Right.
In either case, FINRA treats that linked third-party content as if you wrote it yourself. The link site must now meet all the FINRA content standards.
So if Frank links to the SEC's EDGAR database to show a client a factual 10K filing, he's fine. It's a neutral reference. But if Frank links to a shady crypto blog and tweets, this guy gets it, read this article to see why my new strategy is guaranteed to make you rich, Frank has adopted that blog post.
Yes. The act of linking with an explicit endorsement adopts the content. Frank just made that crypto blog a piece of his firm's retail communication, and I guarantee that blog doesn't meet FINRA's fair and balanced standards.
Definitely not. We've covered the general content rules. Now let's move into specialized communication rules. Looking through the regulations, it seems like some products are so confusing or so inherently risky that the SEC and FINRA built specific obstacle courses just for them.
They definitely did.
Let's start with variable life insurance and variable annuities.
Variable contracts are complex because they're a hybrid. They combine an insurance wrapper with an underlying investment account, usually mutual fund subaccounts. And because of the heavy fees, mortality charges, and steep surrender charges, regulators are intensely protective of how they are marketed.
Okay.
The cardinal rule here, you can never, ever imply that a variable contract is a short-term liquid investment.
So if Frank puts out a flyer calling a variable annuity a highly liquid short-term cash alternative for your emergency fund,
that is an automatic, egregious failure.
Yeah.
If Frank makes any claims about access to your money or liquidity, he must immediately balance those claims with clear, prominent disclosures about the negative impact of early redemptions.
Wow.
Yeah. He has to explain surrender charges and the 10% IRS tax penalty for withdrawals before age 59 and a half. You also have to clarify that any death benefit guarantee is strictly subject to the claims paying ability of the issuing insurance company. It's not guaranteed by the FDIC or the federal government.
Okay, what about CMOs? Collateralized mortgage obligations.
CMOs are mortgage-backed securities cut into tranches with very specific structural risks, namely prepayment risk and extension risk. Retail investors frequently misunderstand them, assuming they act like normal corporate bonds.
I was looking at this section on CMOs in the research, and it struck me that this is one of the only times a FINA actually forces you to be a teacher.
Yes, that's exactly right.
You can't just slap a warning label on the bottom of the ad. If Frank creates a CMO retail communication, the rule demands actual educational content. He has to explain what a tranche is. He has to explain how a drop in interest rates causes homeowners to refinance, which accelerates prepayment risk and returns the investor's principal when they least want it.
That is a brilliant observation. Regulators force the firm to educate because the product is structurally counterintuitive to a retail bond investor. Beyond the education, Frank must disclose that they are backed by mortgages, that the average life is merely an estimate, and that yield will fluctuate.
And as we covered earlier, CMO retail communications are filed post-use, within 10 days. Now let's talk about bond fund volatility ratings.
If Frank wants to market a bond mutual fund, he might want to show how stable it is by using a volatility rating from an independent third party.
But let me guess, regulators are hyper-pedantic about the wording. If Frank puts that rating in his brochure under the giant bold heading risk rating low, what happens?
It's a violation. You can never call a volatility rating a risk rating.
Why not? To a retail investor, volatility and risk sound like the exact same thing.
Because financially, they are completely different. Volatility measures how sensitive the fund's net asset value is to interest rate changes or market swings. Risk, in the regulatory mind, encompasses credit default, counterparty collapse, and operational failure.
Oh, I see.
A highly volatile treasury bond fund has zero credit risk. A completely illiquid junk bond might show low daily volatility, but has massive default risk. They are not the same thing. You must disclose the methodology, ensure the rating is independent, and never use the word risk.
Okay, let's talk about the big one. Investment company ads. specifically mutual funds, the SEC prospectus advertising rule.
If a mutual fund advertisement includes performance figures, it crosses a legal threshold. Under the Securities Act of 1933, that ad is considered a deemed prospectus. Because it's acting as a prospectus, it has to follow rigid, standardized formatting dictated by the SEC. Specifically, it must show standardized average annual total returns for 1, 5, and 10 years as of the most recent calendar quarter.
Direct question to you, the listener. Pause and think about Frank's brochure. Frank's ad shows the 1-year and 3-year returns for a mutual fund that has been around for 12 years. The 1-year and 3-year numbers are totally accurate, verified by the fund company. Is Frank compliant? Give it a second.
Yeah.
Where are the 5 and 10-year returns? The rule requires 1, 5, and 10. If the fund is only 7 years old, you show 1, 5, and life of fund, but you cannot cherry-pick the 3-year return because it looks better and omit the 5 and 10.
And if Frank does cherry-pick that number, he isn't just getting a slap on the wrist from FANARAI.
Exactly. These rules create overlapping layers of liability. If Frank runs a misleading mutual fund ad under the Supplemental Sales Literature Rule, that ad is treated as a filed document under the Investment Company Act of 1940. So Frank is violating FANARAI content standards, the Securities Act anti-fraud rules, and the Investment Company Act, all at the exact same time with one brochure. Man, Frank is drowning in paperwork and violations. Let's step away from the paper, the emails, and the screens. Frank is desperate for new business. He decides to pick up the physical telephone to cold call prospects. Let's get into telemarketing and do not call rules.
Telemarketing is heavily scrutinized because it is so intrusive. The golden rule is the time window. You can only cold call a residence between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m.
But whose 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. is it? Because this is a classic trap. Let's say Frank is in his office in New York, which is Eastern time. He's calling a list of prospects in Los Angeles, which is Pacific time. Frank makes the call at 9:00 p.m. Eastern. Is he violating the rule?
He is completely fine. The rule dictates it is the local time at the call party's location. 9:00 p.m. in New York is only 6:00 p.m. in Los Angeles.
Right.
Rita in L.A. is well within the 8 to 9 window. The clock runs on the recipient's wall, not the caller's wall.
What if Frank wants to call Happy Harry, his existing customer, at 7 a.m. to discuss a market crash in Asia?
Existing customers are exempt from the time of day restriction. He can call his actual client at 7 a.m. But a cold prospect, never.
Now let's talk about the do not call lists. Regulators didn't just make one list. They made two separate layers of DNC lists, and Frank has to navigate both.
Right. There's the firm-specific list, and there is the National DNC Registry.
Okay, break those down.
The firm-specific list is maintained internally by Frank's broker-dealer. It's a list of people who have explicitly told Frank or his reps, stop calling me. The firm must honor those requests within a reasonable time, usually 30 days. The National DNC Registry is the massive database maintained by the FTC. Firms have to scrub their outbound call lists against the National Registry, and they must use a copy of the registry that is no older than 31 days.
Okay, listener, memorize that number, 31 days. If Frank is scrubbing his prospect list against a database he downloaded 32 days ago, he is in violation of federal law with every call he makes. But wait, what if Frank has an exception? Let's talk about the EBR, the existing business relationship exception. This is a massive loophole if you understand how it works.
If you have an EBR, you get to bypass the National DNC list entirely. But there are two different types of EBR windows depending on the depth of the relationship.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison. We have a transaction-based EBR and an inquiry-based EBR.
If the customer actually bought something from you or deposited money in an account, that's a transaction. The EBR lasts for 18 months from the date of that last transaction. If the customer didn't buy anything, but they called your office to ask a question about a product, an inquiry, the EBR only lasts for 3 months from the date of the inquiry.
That makes perfect logical sense. An actual financial transaction shows high intent and trust, so regulators give you a year and a half to follow up. A passing question shows low intent, so you only get 90 days. But let me clarify something, because this is where Frank is going to get himself sued. The EBR exempts you from the National DNC list, and it exempts you from the 8 to 9 time of day restriction. But it does not exempt you from the firm-specific list, does it?
That is a critical nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say Happy Harry is Frank's best client. They do trades every single month. Harry definitely qualifies for the 18-month EBR. But one day, Harry gets annoyed with Frank's constant pitching and says, Frank, take me off your call list. Seriously, stop calling me.
Harry's had enough.
Frank must put Harry on the firm-specific list immediately. The EBR does not give you permission to ignore a direct, verbal stop calling me request. If Frank calls him the next day claiming he has an EBR, Frank is in violation.
Now, what about wireless numbers? Cell phones. Frank buys a list of cell phone numbers. He doesn't want to dial them all manually, so he decides to use an auto dialer to leave pre-recorded voice messages. He figures, hey, some of these guys are my clients. I have an EBR. It's totally fine.
If Frank does that, he might bankrupt his firm.
Wow, really?
If you use an auto dialer or a pre-recorded voice message to call a wireless number, you need prior express written consent. The EBR exception does not save you here.
Why is the rule so draconian for cell phones?
It goes back to the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, or TCPA. Historically, cell phone users paid by the minute or by the text message. So if a business used a machine to blast 10,000 robocalls to cell phones, they were literally forcing the consumer to pay for the privilege of being spammed. Therefore, the law requires their signature, electronic or physical, saying you have permission to use an auto dialer on their mobile device.
That makes sense. So telemarketing is a minefield of federal statutes. But let's look at who Frank is hiring to make these phone calls. Frank is desperate for growth. So he hires a bunch of brokers who used to work at really shady boiler room firms that just got shut down by the SEC. This triggers one of my absolute favorite FINRA regulations, the taping rule.
The taping rule is essentially FINRA's disciplined hire firewall. It's designed for firms that hire a high concentration of registered persons from firms that were expelled from the industry or had their SEC registration revoked for sales practice violations.
Why does FINRA care where they used to work? If the individual broker didn't get banned, why penalize Frank's firm for hiring them?
It's about systemic culture. FINRA's logic is that if you hire a critical mass of people who were trained in a boiler room culture, they're going to infect your firm with that same culture. They learned bad habits, high-pressure sales, unauthorized trading, ignoring DNC lists. FINRA wants to quarantine that behavior.
So Frank hires his buddies from Shady Securities LLC, which just got expelled. What are the mathematical triggers that put Frank's new firm in regulatory timeout?
It scales based on the size of Frank's firm. If the firm has 5 to 9 registered reps, the rule triggers if 40% of them are from disciplined firms.
Okay.
If the firm is a bit larger, 10 to 19 reps, it triggers if 4 or more reps are from disciplined firms. Mm. Notice that's a flat number for that tier, not a percentage. And if the firm has 20 or more reps, it triggers if 20% or more are from disciplined firms.
Okay, so Frank has a 10-person firm. He just hired 4 guys from expelled Shady Securities. He hit the 4 or more threshold exactly. What happens the moment he hits that number?
Frank will receive a notification from FINRA, or he should realize it himself through his compliance software. He now has a choice to make. FINRA gives him a one-time 30-day reduction window.
Like an escape hatch.
Exactly. It's an escape hatch. If he fires enough of those disciplined hires within 30 days to fall back below the threshold, he avoids the taping obligation entirely.
The 30-day escape hatch. But Frank is stubborn. He likes these guys. They bring in revenue. What if he ignores the 30-day window?
Then the hammer comes down. If he doesn't reduce the headcount, he has 60 days from the original notification to set up special written procedures and begin tape recording telephone conversations.
Ouch.
And here's the brutal part. He doesn't just record the 4 guys from Shady Securities. He has to tape record every single registered person at the firm, all of their customer calls.
Oh, wow. So Frank's innocent employees who have never had a compliance issue in their lives are suddenly getting their calls recorded and scrutinized just because Frank hired the wrong guys.
Exactly. The firm must implement a massive technological infrastructure to record everyone, review the takes, and file quarterly reports with FINRA detailing what they found on those tapes. And they must keep these recordings.
For how long?
The recordings must be kept for 3 years, with the first 2 years in an easily accessible place.
Now, this brings up a massive jurisdictional conflict I noticed in the research. Does Frank have to tell the customers they are being recorded? Because FINRA's rule doesn't explicitly mandate a disclosure beep, right?
This is a fascinating intersection of federal self-regulatory rules and state law. FINRA itself does not explicitly require you to tell the customer they are being recorded under the taping rule. However, state wiretap laws overlay this entirely.
Right. If Frank is in New York, which is a one-party consent state, he's fine. But what if Frank calls a customer in California, Florida, or Pennsylvania? Those are two-party consent states. State law dictates that both parties on the call must consent to the recording.
If Frank doesn't announce the recording, he might perfectly satisfy FINRA's taping rule, but he is committing a felony under California state wiretap laws. So in practice, any firm subject to the taping rule must implement a recorded announcement. This call is being recorded for quality and compliance purposes at the beginning of every call to ensure they don't run afoul of state laws.
All right, we are nearing the end of Frank's disastrous journey. We've made the ads, the principal approved them, FINRA has a copy, we made the cold calls, and we even recorded the bad apples. Now, where do we put all this paper, and for how long? Let's dive into books and records and then cap it off with the anti-touting prohibition.
Record-keeping is the unglamorous backbone of the entire industry. It's a paper trail that proves to SEC examiners that you actually followed all the rules we just talked about over the last hour. The SEC books and records retention rule sets a baseline.
I want to spend a minute here because the logic behind the timelines is important. How long do we keep communications versus how long do we keep customer account records?
Under SEC rules, all communications relating to the firm's business, including retail ads, correspondence, internal office memos, and internal emails, must be kept for 3 years, with the first 2 years easily accessible.
Why does the SEC care so much more about a six-year retention for some things? Because I remember reading about a six-year rule. What is that?
Customer account records, like account opening forms, KYC information, and principal designations, are kept for 6 years. Think about the logic. An account record establishes the fundamental identity, suitability, and legal authority of the relationship. Regulators need a long tail on that to investigate fraud or money laundering. Communications like a flyer or a daily market update email are ephemeral business records. 3 years is sufficient to capture a cycle of sales practice exams.
But test writers will definitely try to cross these wires. They'll ask you how long to keep a retail brochure and offer 6 years as an answer. It's 3 years for comms, 6 years for accounts.
Correct. And remember, FINRA's layer on top of the SEC rule says you don't just keep the PDF of the email. You keep the record of who approved it, who reviewed it, and the exact dates of first and last use. It's not just keeping the paper. It's keeping the metadata of compliance. If you recall our clean room analogy from the beginning where Frank accidentally CC'd retail Rita, when SEC examiners come in 3 years later, they aren't just looking at the email, they are looking at the distribution list to ensure Frank didn't contaminate a bucket.
That brings it all full circle.
Yeah.
Now let's briefly touch on the SEPA logo rule before we hit the grand finale. SEPA is the Securities Investor Protection Act. Most broker-dealers are SIPC members, which protects customer cash and securities if the firm goes bankrupt.
But if you are a specialty firm that is not a SIPC member, like a firm that strictly deals in mutual funds or a pure municipal dealer, you cannot display the SIPC logo on your marketing, and you cannot advertise that you have comparable protection. It's a simple anti-fraud measure.
Pretty straightforward. Don't claim you have SIPC insurance if you don't. Now, the grand finale of the communications unit, the anti-touting prohibition. I call this the don't bribe influencers for hype rule.
That is exactly what it is, and it has become exponentially more relevant in the age of social media. The anti-touting prohibition bars a firm from giving anything of value, cash, meals, trips, stock to anyone for the purpose of influencing or rewarding the publication of a communication that affects the security's market price.
Let's bring Financial Frank back for one last disastrous decision. Frank's firm is failing. The taping rule is costing him a fortune. He has a thinly traded penny stock he needs to pump up to generate trading commissions. He finds a popular TikTok finance influencer. Frank takes this influencer out for a $500 steak dinner, slides an envelope of cash across the table, and casually suggests the influencer make a video hyping this specific penny stock. The influencer makes the video, it goes viral. What did Frank just do?
Frank just detonated his career.
Yeah.
That is undisclosed paid promotion designed to move a market price. It is market manipulation disguised as organic commentary.
Are there any exceptions? What if Frank wants to pay for legitimate marketing?
You can pay for content if it is clearly and conspicuously labeled as paid advertising. Or you can use the federal touting disclosure provision exception.
Let's break that down because this is where the specifics matter. What does Frank actually have to disclose to make that TikTok legal?
The federal rule requires you to disclose both the receipt of compensation and the exact nature or amount of the consideration.
So if the TikToker puts a hashtag that says sponsored post or ad, is that enough to satisfy the SEC?
No. Just saying sponsored or paid without stating the amount or nature of the compensation is illegal under the federal provision. They would have to explicitly say, I received a $500 dinner and a cash payment from Financial Frank to talk about this stock. The audience has to know exactly how compromised the speaker is.
And if they don't do that, the liability cascades. A single act of undisclosed paid touting triggers an absolute avalanche of regulatory violations.
It triggers four separate layers of violations simultaneously. One, the FINRA anti-touting prohibition we just discussed. 2, the SEC federal touting disclosure provision, because you didn't state the exact amount. 3, the broad SEC anti-fraud provision, Rule 10b-5, because it's inherently deceitful to the market. And 4, the FINRA content standards, because a communication is misleading by omitting a material conflict of interest.
Frank buys one steak dinner and gets hit with 4 separate regulatory sledgehammers. That is why this is the capstone of the entire communications unit.
It closes the loop perfectly. You can follow every approval workflow, you can hit every 10-day filing window with advertising regulation, and you can satisfy every 3-year SEC retention rule perfectly. But if you secretly pay someone to distort the market, you fail the entire regime. The regulators care about substantive truth just as much as they care about procedural paperwork.
All right, take a deep breath. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the biggest testable takeaways we covered today. Lock these in. Ready. Retail versus correspondence. What's the dividing line?
26 or more retail investors is retail. 25 or fewer is correspondence.
Mutual fund ad filing versus a mutual fund ad with a self-created ranking. What's the timing?
The standard mutual fund ad is post-use, within 10 days. The self-created ranking flips the requirement to pre-use at least 10 days before.
The EBR exceptions for cold calling, how long do they last?
18 months from a financial transaction. 3 months from a mere inquiry.
Document retention. Communications versus account records.
3 years for communications, with 2 years easily accessible, 6 years for customer account records.
And finally, the taping rule setup windows.
You have a 30-day window to fire the bad brokers and avoid the rule entirely. If you don't, you have 60 days to set up the taping procedures.
Amazing. Now, as we wrap up, I want to look at where this is all heading. We've talked a lot about Frank and his manual emails.
The frontier of these rules is the hyperlink adoption rule we discussed earlier.
Right.
We are moving incredibly fast into an era where AI-generated summaries, automated social media feeds, and algorithmic curation are finding and sharing links for us. If your firm's automated marketing algorithm retweets a link that contains a promissory statement or lie, has your firm adopted it without a human ever even reading it?
Oh, wow.
The rules of tomorrow are going to have to reckon with the technology of today. The definition of adoption and approval is going to get very, very complicated as machines take over the correspondence bucket.
That is wild to think about. An AI bot accidentally violating the FINRA content standards and catching 4 layers of SEC anti-fraud charges while the principal is asleep.
We're living in the future, but the rules are very much enforced today. Remember, institutional Ian in his money suit, retail Rita walking into the clean room, and financial Frank causing chaos everywhere he goes. Unpack these rules, memorize those numbers, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.